Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. European Union observers say that despite logistical problems, Guinea's presidential election Sunday appeared to be free and fair. The comments Tuesday from the EU observer team and its chief, Frick Engel, are at odds with opposition candidates who say the election was rigged to favor President Alpha Conde and should be annulled. A four-page statement from the EU team said the poll was marred by technical errors such as unalphabetized voter list and confusion over when polling stations closed. But in an interview with VOA, Engel said the massive ballot box stuffing and vote rigging alleged by the opposition could not be verified by EU observers. Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine by a Russian-made Buk missile. According to the Dutch Safety Board's conclusions Tuesday in its final report on the July 2014 crash that killed all 298 people on board. This is the Safety Board head, Jibba Jastra, presenting the report.
Flight MH17 crashed because of a 9N314M warhead detonated outside the aeroplane above the left side of the cockpit. This warhead fits the kind of missile that is installed on the Buk surface-to-air missile system.
However, there is no idea as to who launched that missile. The glut of the oil global market has pushed down the price of crude. It's likely to continue into 2016. That's according to the International Energy Agency Tuesday. The group said forecast a marked slowdown in the demand for oil. VOA News. The social messaging platform Twitter said Tuesday that it was cutting 8% of its workforce or 336 jobs in a restructuring of the company under the newly returned chief executive Jack Dorsey. The layoffs come just 2 weeks after Twitter brought back Dorsey, one of the co-founders, as a permanent CEO in an effort to tackle problems that has slowed user growth at the messaging service. The governor of Japan's southern island of Okinawa has followed through with a promise to revoke permits for construction of a new U.S. airbase on his island, setting up a possible legal showdown with the central government in Tokyo. Takeshi Onaga announced the move on Tuesday, a month after he said his government would take action after discovering defects in the original permits issued by his predecessor. Three Israelis have been killed in a new wave of shooting and stabbing attacks by Palestinians in Jerusalem and elsewhere. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
The escalating Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians come at a time of stalemate in the peace process. Israeli analyst Moshe Amirav believes Israel should make the first diplomatic move.
We are the strong one. We are ruling the West Bank and Jerusalem. It's up to us to initiate new ideas and arrangements with the Palestinians.
Israel says it is prepared to return to the negotiating table today without preconditions. But the Palestinians say Israel's expansion of West Bank settlements and its refusal to withdraw to the 1967 borders means there is nothing to talk about. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Iran's parliament passed a bill Tuesday approving the country's nuclear deal with a group of six world powers. The state-run IRNA news agency said lawmakers voted 161 for and 59 against the bill, with 13 abstaining. Under the deal, Iran will limit its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. The Taliban say they're withdrawing from Kunduz. That's a city that briefly fell to the insurgents last month. And an Afghan official said life there is returning to normal. A Taliban spokesman said in an email to the media Tuesday that the fighters are retreating to avoid further civilian casualties. Insurgent rockets fired at Russia's embassy in Damascus Tuesday in what the Russian foreign minister called as an act of terror meant to intimidate those who support the fight against Islamic State militants. The two rockets struck the embassy compound as hundreds of people rallied outside in support of Russia's campaign in Syria. And the Democrats are getting their turn in a series of debates beginning Tuesday in Las Vegas for the 2016 election campaign. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency condemns two suicide attacks by Nigeria's militant Boko Haram group in western Chad over the weekend, killing and maiming scores of people, among them internally displaced people.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details next.
Also in the news, the International Organization for Migration estimates that more than 3,100 people have died while trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe this year, and more than 400,000 people in Burundi will need humanitarian aid in the aftermath of a disputed July re-election of President Pierre Nkurunziza.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency condemns two suicide attacks by Nigeria's militant Boko Haram group in western Chad over the weekend, killing and maiming scores of people, among them internally displaced people. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Suicide bombers, including three women and two teenage boys, attacked a fish market Saturday in the Chadian town of Bagasola and the Kuseri site for internally displaced people on the outskirts of the city. The attacks left 47 dead and wounded dozens of others. Nearly half of the dead were from the displaced people's camp. UN refugee spokesman Leo Dobbs tells VOA this is the first such attack in Bagasola.
In recent weeks and months, the government has encouraged people to move away from the islands in Lake Chad as it gears up for an offensive against Boko Haram. And so tens of thousands have moved from their homes and they've been displaced and they find it very difficult to cope.
A new 8,700-member regional force has been set up in Chad to tackle militant Boko Haram Islamists. It has not yet started operations. In recent weeks, Dobbs says the UNHCR has stepped up assistance to the 60,000 internally displaced people who normally live on islands in the lake.
Their lives have been disrupted by the increasing violence that has spread from Nigeria into neighboring countries. These people are living in desperate conditions. They lack livelihoods, they lack shelter, they lack food, they lack healthcare.
The UNHCR is one of several agencies that work in the Dar es Salaam refugee camp, 10 kilometers from Bagasola. Dobbs says all aid workers and more than 7,000 refugees in the camp from Nigeria and Niger are safe. But he says travel to and within the Lake Chad region has been suspended and UN flights are on standby to transport people out of the area or bring in emergency supplies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union's Border Patrol Agency says migrant flows have slowed slightly due to worsening weather on the Mediterranean and a shortage of boats in Libya. Frontex officials say crossing from the Libyan coast to Italy fell by 50% in September. The total of all entries to Europe for the month, including those sailing the eastern route from Turkey to Greece, was 170,000. An estimated 190,000 migrants reached Europe in August. However, Frontex says recent monthly totals remain high. The total of migrants reaching Europe is 710,000 for the past 9 months. About 202,000 migrants entered Europe in 2014. The International Organization for Migration estimates that more than 3,100 people have died while trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe this year. 90% of those deaths were drownings of migrants taken by smugglers on rubber rafts and small, not seaworthy craft from Libya to Italy.
A new UN UN report says to break the cycle of poverty and hunger, greater social protection is needed for the world's rural poor. This includes cash transfers, school feeding programs, and public works projects. The recommendations are found in the State of Food and Agriculture 2015 report. VOA's Joe DiCapua has the story.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization report, known as SOFA, says considerable progress has been made in recent decades in fighting global hunger and poverty. But it says progress has been uneven, and about 795 million people continue to suffer from hunger. The number includes many small-scale farmers. FAO Director General José Graziano da Silva says it is urgent to act to support the most vulnerable people to free the world of hunger.
We need not only food, we need healthy food to promote healthy lives. And we need a comprehensive approach to food and nutrition security, using social protection to break the rural poverty cycle.
Social protection includes what are called three broad components: social assistance, social insurance, and labor market protection. The report says eradicating hunger and poverty requires a combination of sustained private and public investments and social protection measures. It's estimated that would cost $267 billion a year for the next 15 years. Graziano da Silva says repeated external shocks have become the new normal for many poor.
Poor families are also extremely vulnerable to external shocks, such as floods, pests, drought, and price volatility. With the climate change, the shocks happen year after year. They eat away the capacity of rural poor families to cope with it.
Jomo Sundaram is FAO Assistant Director General and Coordinator for Economic and Social Development.
Most of the poor and hungry continue to live in rural areas. According to the World Bank, about 78% of the poor are rural.
The SOFA report says that economic growth, especially agricultural development, has been essential for driving down poverty rates. However, it adds that even with economic growth, the struggle to escape poverty is often slow, as growth may not be inclusive.
We know that the state of the world economy is poor and the prospects for improvement are very bleak, particularly given the austerity policies of many countries.
Sundaram says the new UN Sustainable Development Goals make many references to social protection.
Most of the poor and vulnerable continue to be in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. This is an unfortunate reality which we will have to deal with for some time to come.
He says an increase in natural disasters and conflicts make eradicating poverty and hunger more difficult.
Social protection basically not only protects the poor and prevents some of the worst forms of human deprivation, it also reduces food insecurity and seasonal hunger.
The FAO official says having social protection in place for the poor allows governments to act more quickly in times of crisis. Sundaram says it should be part of a broader rural development strategy. The Food and Agriculture Organization report estimates more than 2 billion people receive some form of social protection. It says that most countries, even the poorest, can afford such programs. The report adds that programs aimed at women enhance food security and nutrition. Social protection, it says, also stimulates investment in agriculture, while public works programs provide important infrastructure and community assets that contribute directly to the local economy. SOFA does warn that without public assistance, many of the poor and vulnerable will suffer unnecessary hardship and lasting deprivation, perpetuating poverty for future generations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. While the Ebola crisis that hit the three West African countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea may be over, but recovery and rebuilding from the devastating virus is a long process. Our colleague Jackson Mbunganyi is traveling throughout the region and is presently in Sierra Leone just after leaving Liberia. He spoke with me about his trip first to Monrovia.
In Monrovia, I was there for the past 4 days in the capital city, and I visited the suburbs. Looks like life has relatively returned to normal. Government offices are open. The markets are open. School children are going to school. Health services are being provided. And that fear that characterized these two communities, and I'm talking about these two societies, Liberia and Sierra Leone, there's not as much fear anymore of Ebola because they feel like the worst days are behind them now.
Looking ahead, what changes have they put in place to be able to deal with another emergency or another crisis?
I think they've learned a couple of lessons during this crisis. They've learned how to better adequately respond to an emergency of this magnitude. They have put in place, with the help of bilateral organizations, international organizations, donor friends, countries like the U.S., they've put in place a system where they can easily respond to any outbreak of the magnitude that we saw, you know, last year.
How have people's attitudes changed towards Ebola?
Speaking to the people on the streets in Monrovia, there's been an understanding on how to handle themselves in case they get the messages from either the government or other sources of information that there's an outbreak. One of the main reasons why Ebola was able to affect as many people as it did, there was a bit of doubt in Liberia. People are not used to getting credible information from their governments. And so for so long, they doubted that this was a real threat. And it was not only after the death of one of the government officials last year that people actually started understanding that this was a threat.
So I understand that you have also visited some schools. What has been going on? There's been over a year of loss of education.
It seems that schools are back to normal now. In some areas, students have to go half day for part of the day, and then another group of students have to come in again for the remainder of the day. But students did lose over a year, at least 7 months of their education, and that affected them in so many ways. There's also another level to this, in as there were students who were planning to study abroad who had received scholarships, but those were turned down after the outbreak of Ebola because of the stigma, obviously, related to that. But I visited like a school or two where they have a much better understanding of the threat that Ebola posed to their society. They are putting precautionary measures in these schools. Before you enter each class, you have to wash your hands. There are hand sanitizers being handed out. I spoke to a school nurse in this elementary and high school where the school nurse says that she has gotten a lot more help now from the school administration in case there's any outbreak in the school. Another thing, Kim, is that students have become ambassadors of information to their communities, to their local communities. One of the main roles that students played in their local communities, they became community organizers and community educators. They were carrying around flyers, educational material about what Ebola is and how it affects them. But many of them spent 7 to 8 months just at home, secluded, not even allowed to play with their friends because there was an active threat of something that many of them did not know about. But they saw their friends dying. They had news over the radio about thousands of people dying. And there was a lot of fear in their communities about this epidemic.
How have they changed their attitudes towards healthcare workers?
One of the biggest casualties of Ebola were health workers. Many of them died because they were in touch or in contact with those who were affected. They had to provide primary health care to the people who were affected by Ebola, and so many of them died. People around their communities who were going to them for treatment also started fearing them. What that meant is that if you had any other condition which was not Ebola, if you had malaria or any other disease, you were scared of going to the hospitals to get care. The trust is starting to come back slowly. Many of them feel like their communities have not fully recovered from this epidemic, so there's still a hesitation on some part to visit these healthcare centers where they're testing a treatment of Ebola. But slowly and slowly, I feel like they're getting to that level where things will return to normal very soon.
That was our colleague Jackson Mvunganyi speaking to us from Freetown, Sierra Leone. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehia Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
More than 400,000 people in Burundi will need humanitarian aid in the aftermath of a disputed July re-election of President Pierre Nkurunziza. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, says an estimated 500,000 people have been affected by violence and displacement. OCHA officials say help for the majority of the 500,000 affected will cost $35 million. They have increased earlier estimates of the need for protection, given the potential for continued violence. The UN Human Rights Agency says there have been 134 killings, 90 cases of torture, and hundreds of cases of arbitrary arrest. The agency says there were 704 arrests in September. The turmoil began when opposition leaders challenged Mr. Nkurunziza's announcement that he would run for a third term. About 200,000 Burundians fled the country, including large numbers of opposition leaders and journalists. Mr. Nkurunziza's re-election was considered unconstitutional by many in the region and opposed by international donors. Burundi has a history of deadly conflicts in which the country's Hutu and Tutsi ethnic groups targeted each other. Nkurunziza took power in 2005, near the end of a civil war in which an estimated 300,000 people were killed between 1993 and 2006.
An estimated 100,000 current and ex-miners in South Africa are seeking permission to pursue a class action lawsuit against 32 gold mining companies. The miners say they contracted the lung diseases, silicosis and tuberculosis in the mines. Tuso Kamala reports from Johannesburg, where hundreds of people marched to the Gauteng High Court in support of the miners.
Marchers came out in their hundreds to support the affected miners, most of whom say they were dismissed from work after contracting the respiratory illnesses, silicosis and TB. 61-year-old Bangumuzi Palagisa worked for 25 years in several gold mines before he was diagnosed. In 1999, he was dismissed from work and given a package that he calls peanuts. He says TB and silicosis rendered him useless and he cannot walk a long distance because of breathing problems. He says the miners are sitting at home and cannot afford to send their children to school and they want compensation. Palagisa is one of 56 plaintiffs representing the miners and asking the Johannesburg High Court to grant them permission to sue the gold mining companies. Spokesperson Patrick Godana of Sonke Gender Justice, one of several civil society groups at the march, says these companies have to take responsibility for miners who contracted disease on their watch.
They are sent home to go and die. They become the burden of care to their wives and their daughters. They call to the mine owners. We are saying, look after the mine workers who have contracted silicosis and pay them accordingly.
Inside the court, lawyers representing the miners argued a class action suit will enable justice for all the affected miners, including those who cannot afford legal representation. But the mining companies argue each case should be considered individually. The court will continue to hear the arguments until October 23. This is the first attempt to institute a class action lawsuit in South Africa. If the court allows it, experts say mining companies could face a payout of up to $3 billion if found liable. The miners say they will not give up. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Tanzania's presidential elections are less than 2 weeks away, and analysts are debating whether the country's ruling party can retain the presidency. A party favorite was passed over the nomination, so he defected and became the opposition party's candidate. VOA's Jill Craig gives an election preview from Nairobi.
Tanzania's general election is fast approaching and is considered to be the country's most contested since the return of multi-party politics in 1992. Incumbent President Jakaya Kikwete decided to step down after two terms in office, clearing the way for a campaign season filled with plenty of twists and turns. Research associate Adjua Animadu is with the Africa program at Chatham House in London.
What we have at the moment is an election that no one really could have predicted, I think, this time last year. Early on in the race towards the presidential candidate being chosen for CCM, many people predicted that that candidate would be Edward Lowassa because he's been a long-standing, prominent member of that party.
But Chama Cha Mapinduzi, or CCM, the country's dominant ruling party, held its presidential primaries in July and instead selected a relatively unknown candidate.
The choice of John Magufuli, the current Minister of Works, as CCM's candidate came as a surprise to most people. He wasn't necessarily very well known internationally. He wasn't someone who was considered to have an international profile. But within Tanzania, he's very well respected for having been a successful Minister of Works, having presided over a lot of the development that Tanzania really desperately needs, so road developments and this kind of thing.
Edward Lowassa was Prime Minister under President Kikwete from 2005 until 2008, when he stepped down after being implicated in the Richmond energy scandal. As a former party elite, Lowassa has remained popular and still retains support within CCM. But once he was passed over as CCM's presidential candidate, he defected to Chadema, Tanzania's main opposition party. In August, he was named the presidential candidate for UKAWA, a coalition of four opposition parties, including Chadema. American University Associate Professor of Government Adrian Labaugh says Lowassa is the candidate whose name has become synonymous with scandal.
He does have a reputation for corruption, and when he was prime minister, the opposition used to run on a sort of clean broom kind of campaign, fighting corruption inside the administration. And so they've now placed this corrupt minister as their flag bearer.
She says both of the leading candidates are promising to improve lives for ordinary Tanzanians.
Both are really running on services provision, saying that they're going to bring water, education, or, you know, roads or electricity or any of these things that voters want. Now, in the past, in Tanzania, opposition parties haven't really been able to run on that platform very effectively because they don't have any track record actually delivering services.
But because Lowassa is a former prime minister, Labaugh says he can tell voters that he's already brought them services, whether building a dam or bringing them water. Yet another twist in this year's election cycle. Tanzanians head to the polls on October 25th. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. This one I judge, this one I judge. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent, old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Refugee Agency condemns two suicide attacks by Nigeria's militant Boko Haram group in western Chad. And the IOM estimates that more than 3,100 people have died while trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe this year. And we'll have music, and in our feature segment, a post-election survey in Nigeria indicates this year's presidential elections were free and fair. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young today. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim will kick off with the FIFA qualifiers.
Okay.
Thank you very much. In today's qualifiers, Madagascar held Central African Republic to a 2-2 draw on Tuesday to complete a 5-2 aggregate win in their preliminary round qualifier for the 2018 World Cup. Madagascar will face Senegal in the next round. The match between Swaziland and Djibouti has been postponed. Meanwhile, Malawi beat Tanzania 1-0 at home at the Kamuzu Stadium in Blantyre, but the Taifa Stars went Blantyre with a 2-0 advantage from their home leg on Wednesday to go through 2-1 overall. Tanzania face a difficult fixture in the next round of qualifying. They will take on Africa's top-ranked side, Algeria, as they continue their bid to reach Russia 2018. In football, Manchester City's midfielder Yaya Toure is in line to win a fifth straight Africa Player of the Year award. Toure has been included on an initial list of 37 names for the Confederation of African Football's annual title, which will be announced on December 22nd. The Ivory Coast captain led his side to the Africa Cup of Nations title in February in Equatorial Guinea. DR Congo keeper Robert Kidiaba is one of four players also on the 24-man list for the Africa Best Player of the Year. If Toure claims the fifth title, he will overtake Cameroon's Samuel Eto'o, who has won the award four times. Toure's international teammates Givino, Max Gradel, and Segi Arura are the other names on the international list for the Nation Cup winning squad. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Here is Mark.
We begin with football. Hosts Morocco and Guinea play to a 1-1 draw in Agadir as the Democratic Republic of Congo pipped Gabon 2-1 in Mones, Belgium, in friendly matches on Monday. On Sunday, Tunisia's under-23 side pipped Rwanda 1-0, while on Friday, Burkina Faso edged Rwanda 1-0 in friendly matches played in Rabat, Morocco. Today, Tuesday, Republic of Congo host Benin in Brazzaville. Algeria welcomed Senegal to Algiers. Honduras encountered the visiting South Africans in San Pedro, and Ghana Canada in Washington, D.C. in the United States of America. Turning to athletics, Kenya's 22-year-old Gladys Chesire won women's race at the ASICS Grand 10-kilometer Berlin Road Race in the German capital in a lifetime best of 30 minutes and 41 seconds. A silver medalist in 10,000 meters at the recent All-Africa Games, Chesire not only improved her lifetime best by over 1 minute, but also ran the world's quickest time in the event this year. Meanwhile, 19-year-old World Junior 10,000-meter champion Joshua Cheptegei triumphed in the men's race. In a personal best and Uganda national record of 27 minutes and 50 seconds, he improves on Moses Kipsiro's previous Ugandan record by 2 seconds. In the Netherlands, Kenya's Stephen Chebogut won the DLL Eindhoven Marathon in a personal best of 2 hours, 5 minutes and 52 seconds on Sunday. He improves his lifetime best by over 2 minutes. Meanwhile, Kenyans Stephen Ongori and Nancy Kimayo were crowned winners of the men's and women's races at the 20 kilometers Paris road race in the French capital on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Ethiopian defending champion Mukhtar Edris retained his Giro Alsace 10-kilometer road race title in Trento, Italy, in a winning time of 28 minutes and 46 seconds.
Thanks, Mark. Mark was reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Now in tennis, British number one Johanna Konta has been awarded the lucky loser spot for the main draw in Linz after her defeat in qualifying for the WTA event. Konta, at a career high ranking number 47, lost 6-2, 2-6, 6-4 to world number 105 Clara Kokalova in qualifying. But she will now play German's Annika Beck in the first round on Tuesday. The loss to Czech Kokalova was only Konta's third defeat in 26 matches since Wimbledon and her first to a lower-ranked player since May. The 24-year-old will also play doubles with fellow Briton Naomi Broder in Linz before heading to Luxembourg next week. Konta has followed up her remarkable run to the quarterfinals in Wuhan, China, where she beat world number 2 Simona Halep before losing narrowly to Venus Williams with 2 qualifying wins in Linz. Having broken into the world's top 50 for the first time last week, those 2 wins helped her rise another 2 places to 47 on Monday. Konta's fellow British number 1, Andy Murray, will return to action this week for the first time since Britain's Davis Cup win over Australia last month. The Scot, who is 28, has a bye in round 1 of the Shanghai Masters and will play America's Steve Johnson in round 2. Should he win that, Murray could then face Belgian number 1, David Goffin, with the pair likely to lead their respective nations in the Davis Cup final next month. Novak Djokovic is the top seed in Shanghai and could meet Murray in the semifinals with Roger Federer, Stan Wawrinka, and Rafael Nadal in the opposite half of the draw. Meanwhile, in soccer, Sierra Leone has been eliminated by Chad in the game was played in Port Harcourt in Nigeria. And the winner now, Chad, will play Egypt in the next round. And a programming note here at VOA, Sunny Young is in Lagos, and he'll be meeting and broadcasting with our friends at Brilla on October 13th today and tomorrow, October 14th. Meanwhile, in boxing, Filipino boxing superstar Manny Pacquiao denied earlier reports that he had spoken with Floyd Mayweather Jr. about a rematch, saying he'll be speaking with promoter Bob Arum about his next and final fight when he arrives in New York this week. Speaking at a press conference in Manila, Pacquiao told reporters that he had not had discussions with the recently retired American boxer, despite an AFP report citing him as saying such.
Park Hyo, an 8th Division boxing champion, will be recognized with the 2015 Asia Game Changer Award at the United Nations in New York later this week. Park Hyo says he will discuss with his manager about his options, which also include his one-time gym mate and former junior welterweight title holder Amir Khan. The 36-year-old Park Hyo, who is serving in his second term as a congressman in the Philippines, announced his intention to run for the Philippine State Senate in 2016 last week. He told AFP that he would fight his last fight in a 21-year-old career in March or April, just before the general elections take place on May 9th. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a post-election survey in Nigeria indicates this year's presidential elections was free and fair. And next, the World Health Organization launches new standards to improve the quality of adolescent care. But first, some music. Here is Kobe Maxwell of Ghana with Awuraba.
Good morning, I can't move on, I can't move on. show your stomach. And no boobs, or boom bottom toes. And legs is a more, and high hair is a say. A change your look, a change your style. What's wrong with them?
Call them Cena.
Yes, real was saying.
Say what?
A touch of a tan.
A moko.
A yasunaki.
Sunana Mary.
One body.
One coin you ancho.
Come on, you nani.
Lunge.
Come on, te llamas.
Lisa.
Come on, tita bear.
Je m'appelle Vivette.
What is your name?
Linda.
What is your name?
Lydia.
What is your name?
My name is Lucy.
Jina lako nani.
Kobe Maxwell of Ghana with Auraba.
Well, the International Foundation of Electoral Systems conducted a post-election survey in Nigeria in which over 73% of the voters said this year's presidential elections were free and fair. The former chairman of the Independent National Electoral Commission in Nigeria, Professor Adehiro Jega, spoke about the commission's work in a U.S. Senate panel discussion. VOA reporter Esther Giti asked him what strategies the commission employed.
IFES invited Professor Jega to Capitol Hill to share his insights into this year's election that led to the first democratic transfer of power in Nigeria's history. I sat down with Professor Jega and asked him what strategies INEC employed under his leadership to reach this magnitude of success.
In Nigeria, we did a strategic plan covering the period 2012 to 2016, and it helped us first to do good elections in 2015, but it has also helped us, we believe, to reposition the Electoral Commission to make it one of the best in terms of efficiency and effectiveness in the world.
He says the new commission faced enormous challenges and needed to understand how things were done in the past to plan a successful election.
And I must say that the lessons we learned through that exercise helped us a lot in terms of preparing not just for the 2011 elections, but most especially for the 2015 general elections.
However, the planning was not all smooth sailing. The election slated for February was postponed for 6 weeks as security chiefs issued warnings of imminent attacks from Boko Haram militants. The warning raised doubts among voters and suspicion against the incumbent government of President Goodluck Jonathan. Professor Jega says his commission consulted with stakeholders and security officials.
You know, in our own kind of environment, we also had to factor the consequences of disagreeing publicly with heads of security agencies. And we said, if we thought we could do this election, we proceeded. What if bombs just start exploding everywhere to prove to the commission that you can't do it with, you know, ignoring our advice? So we just decided that it wasn't worth the risk. Good.
The discussion moderated by Voice of America's Africa Division Director, Mr. Neguse Mengecha, also revealed that Nigerian politicians engaged in voter buying, even though the voters had been issued with permanent voter cards. IFES Senior Research, Evolution and Learning Manager Rola Abdulatif said the cards made a difference in the overall integrity of the elections, a point echoed by Professor Jega.
Even though about 25% of the people said they accepted money and gifts, you know, but they said overwhelmingly that they voted in accordance with their preferences, which meant that voters could take money and still vote the people that they really prefer.
Professor Jega, however, cautions politicians and voters alike against employing corrupt practices, saying it weakens the process of building a democratic society.
That was former head of Nigeria's Independent National Election Commission, Professor Adehiro Jega. He was speaking with VOA reporter Esther Gitwe.
UN health officials say healthcare for adolescents is globally substandard and fails to provide critical prevention and care services. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva that the World Health Organization and UNAIDS have just launched new standards to improve the quality of adolescent care.
Young people between the ages of 10 and 19 confront many physical and emotional changes. They do not like to be treated as children, yet they do not know how to behave like adults. Authors of the new adolescent health standards say young people are vulnerable to particular health problems, and many engage in behavior that can lead to disability or death. Anthony Costello, WHO's Director of Maternal, Children's and Adolescents' Health, says lifelong behaviors begin during puberty.
35% of the global burden of disease starts in adolescence. Mental health would be an area particularly where early intervention could make a great deal of difference to the life course, if you like, and the future illnesses in adulthood.
The study cites the top three causes of death among adolescents as road traffic injuries, AIDS-related illnesses, and suicide. UNAIDS senior advisor Dirk van Hove says adolescents are at high risk of HIV/AIDS because of risky behavior.
About 30 cases of new infections among adolescents happen every hour. And HIV among adolescents is still the leading cause of death in sub-Saharan Africa and the second leading cause of death in the world.
The report finds many adolescents who suffer from mental health disorders, substance abuse, poor nutrition, intentional injuries, and chronic illness do not have access to critical prevention and care services. The new standards recommend adolescents be provided with free or low-cost consultations and medical information appropriate for their age, and they should be able to access health services without requiring parental consent. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In its continuing effort to assist other nations in confronting terrorism and to protect American citizens and interests, the United States is offering significant rewards to locate four terrorists operating in Western and Northern Africa. Hamad al-Khairi and Ahmad el-Talemsi are founding members of the Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, or MUJWA, and former members of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Khalid al-Barnawi reportedly leads the Nigeria-based terrorist group Ansaru, and Abu Yusuf al-Muhajir is an explosives expert involved in planning attacks against a variety of targets in Egypt. All four have planned or taken part in violent attacks on Western interests or abductions of foreign nationals. Al-Barnawi, a Nigerian citizen born in 1976, and Ansaru have committed multiple acts of terrorism and kidnappings in his native land.
He is also known as Mohammed Usman, Khalid al-Barnawi, and Abu Hafsa, among other aliases. Al-Khairi, a citizen of Mali, was born in Mauritania in 1970. He has claimed responsibility for the April 2012 kidnapping of seven Algerian diplomats in Mali. He has also appeared in videos making threats against those who oppose his group, which was named a specially designated global terrorist entity by the U.S. Department of State 2 years ago. Al-Khairi is also known as Abu Kamkam and Amada Ould Khairu, among other aliases. Born in 1977, Ahmed El-Talemsi is also Malian and a founding member of the MUJWA. Among its violent activities, in March 2012, the group mounted a suicide attack in Taman Rasset, Algeria, which wounded 23 people. He is also known as Abdurrahmani Ould El-Amar and Abdurrahmani Tujaji. Abu Yusuf al-Muhajir was born September 7, 1986, in Egypt. He has been active in terrorist operations in the Sinai Peninsula, ascribing to a global jihadist ideology and targeting civilians and governments he believes do not abide by Islamic law. He is also known as Hamza al-Maskin, among other aliases. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million each for leading to the location of al-Barnawi, al-Khairi, and al-Talamsi, and up to $3 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of al-Muhajir. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip at www.rewardsforjustice.net. or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You can also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America. Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.